You're listening to the cycling podcast Femina.
Hello and welcome to the Cycling Podcast Femina, or should I say, buongiorno, everybody, because we are in the midst of a mini Italian classic season, aren't we, for the women's peloton. And what I really should be saying, actually, for this episode is benvenuto, welcome, and welcome back, because not only joining me is Rebecca Charlton. Hello, Rebecca.
Hello, Maze.
And Denny Gray.
I've been learning different languages and I was struggling for the word hello in Italian, so sorry for that full start, but hello. I'll just stick with the English, which is what I know best.
Which languages are you learning, Denny? Give us any of them.
Well, obviously my current record speaks not very highly of myself, but yeah, I'm trying to learn Mandarin and Spanish.
What?
On Duolingo. Whoa. But yeah, anyway, so my mind was awash when I was thinking of words for hello. But anyway, I'll just stick with the English.
We would have loved... Well, you just totally kind of hijacked, trying to show off with your polyglot-ism. You've actually totally hijacked our lovely welcome back, and welcome back to Lizzie Banks to the podcast. Lizzie, it's so nice to have you back.
Oh, it's absolutely lovely to be back. Delighted to be back and see all your lovely faces.
Well, that's like, not that you can see that on a podcast. Listeners
hear your lovely voices.
Exactly.
And, yeah, have the chance to talk to you, because sometimes if I listen to the podcast, I try to talk back and I realise nobody's listening. So I guess it's not really that different to being on a podcast, is it?
That's true. But yes, Lizzie obviously has been away fighting a case. And if you do want to hear a bit more about that or read a bit more about it, then I suggest you go to Lizzie Banks's website to hear about what she's been through. But we're not going to talk about that because we want to talk about cycling, don't we? And Lizzie, I'm really excited to hear your thoughts on the, well, let's get straight into it, on the season so far. I know we all know that Lizzie will have a million opinions, and just trying to contain you from saying all your opinions at once is going to be difficult, but we are looking forward to hearing more about that. I should say actually that we have a feature. Our mini feature this episode is about Trofeo Binder, which I decided to cover because, Denny, you said last year that with the return of Milan San Remo, we give so much attention to that race, even though it's kind of just popped up on the calendar, and we don't give enough plaudits to Trofeo Binder, which is the oldest women's race on the calendar. So you can hear more about the history of that and why it's such a significant race a little bit later on. And we will be covering what happened in this year's Trofeo Binder and this year's Strada Bianchi, because it felt like, as much as I wanted to give Binder lots of credit, it did feel like there was so much drama in Strada Bianchi that we really should have been talking about that. So, well, let's get into it, shall we? I mean, Lizzie, let's come to you first. What's your kind of read of the season so far, and particularly these last few races? Because, when you were last cycling, it was all about SD Works, wasn't it? And we've seen a total flip. Do you think that they kind of finally losing their grasp on all of the victories for the women's peloton?
Well, first off, I thought you were going to ask me my opinion on the last nearly 3 years of cycling, and we could have been here for a really, really long time. So I think we should all be grateful for that. But no, I mean, we have seen a massive, massive change. And over the past 2 years, I think, especially in light of what's happened in the last couple of big World Tour races with Trofeo Binder and Strada Bianchi, we've seen this sort of change in the times, and this hold on the peloton from UAE Team ADQ and of course from FDJ United Suez. And these now seem to be the two super teams. And then, you know, if we look back, we were in a position where we'd come to the classics and SD Works hadn't not won a classics race. And now we are looking at a case where we haven't actually had a win from SD Works in the classics. Until today, actually, Lotta Kopecky, just as we were recording, Lotta Kopecky won Nocca Rocorsa. But it's not one of the big Women's World Tour Classics races, and we're really waiting for that to happen. So it's great to see how in both UAE and in FDJ, they've brought in these two big leaders in Elise Longaborghini and in Demi Vollering. And it's taken, I think it's taken a year for both of the teams to really gel, to really understand each other, to really trust each other, and to just have that intuitiveness with racing where you know exactly what to do. And suddenly we've got these two teams who are sort of like way ahead at the moment in what they're doing in the races. And it's pretty cool to see.
Yeah, I mean, it has been so thrilling, hasn't it? Seeing, because we've kind of been asking for that for years, haven't we? Like, I can't remember how many podcasts we did, which was always like, how do you beat SD Works? It was almost seemed like every single month that was the main headline question. And now it's almost like, where the heck are SD Works should be the question, because it's so thrilling to see these teams kind of take up the mantle and dominate in a way that actually SD Works sort of never did, because they would always be so sat back. They would, in a way, they would kind of make the winning move historically, but they wouldn't be doing much of the, you know, the fight back and the constant counterattacks. So it's kind of seeing a different dynamic to how we see the racing playing out. How do you read it, Becca, seeing UAE come to the front? And you know, in every race this season, we've seen them come to the front, haven't we?
Yeah, it's, I think, the overarching theme, and I know we've talked about this so much in the last couple of seasons, but that levelling up. I mean, for me as a commentator, I'm now going into every race with so much more kind of awareness that there really could be anybody that's coming through now. And I think it goes back to the point where we've seen with UAE, Team ADQ, that it, and indeed with FDJ very recently, that if a plan A doesn't pull off, they've got this plan C and plan B and plan C, because they have got such strength in numbers now that actually when the out and out favourite isn't able to secure it, in the case of Demi Vollering, having a mechanical and then going off route, and we'll talk about that, I'm sure, in more detail a little bit later. But when that plan A doesn't come off, they're teams that can now still win the bike race, not just, oh, well, they were still present and they still gave it a go and animated the race, even though they lost their leader's kind of plan. They're winning the bike race. And I think that's been a major theme coming into this season, is just the amount of riders in these super teams. And it's been a complete game changer. A rider for me that you know that I've had a close eye on for a couple of seasons now, and I just want to talk about,
is Franzi Rennevibus.
It's just up and coming sprint star called Rennevibus. No, Franzi Koch has been amazing me for a long time now, and you know that I kept talking about the fact that she was transferring to Team FDJ, and I just think we knew she was a plucky rider. Like, she's always somebody that would just go for it, and she's such an animating rider. But what she has done early this season with the new team is just phenomenal. Like, she is an absolute superstar. I'm not sure in the making or if she already just is a superstar out and out. I mean, the way she has been riding for her teammates, and then just look at her at the end of Strada. Like, she had the ability to win that race. I mean, you've got two contenders there that weren't plan A in Demi Vollering, who are then both in contention for the win. I just can't get over how well Franzi has just come into that team, not only done her role, but shown what depth they have. It's quite phenomenal.
You talk about her transferring, Becca, but I think the word is transforming. You know, she has transformed herself into a different rider. A few years ago, I was talking to her about, you know, oh, she wasn't selected for the Tour de France Femme team because, you know, she couldn't get over the hills. And over this, you know, I would say a little bit over last season, but over the winter, she has just transformed herself into this rider that can do anything and can get up the climbs. And going into that final of Strade Bianche, there were eight riders there. And I thought, well, okay, there's maybe seven that can win this, because Franzi has done so much work for the team. So she's going to get dropped. And then going up the Via Santa Caterina, we thought, she might win this.
She was at the front, wasn't she?
She was at the front, yeah.
On that final climb, she was leading the likes of Cascianini Doma and Elisa Longo Borghini. It was absolutely crazy.
But no, she's transformed the type of rider that she was. She was a flat power, you know, sprinter domestique. And now she is just the most all all-rounded, well-rounded bike rider, domestique, potential winner, time trialist. She can do everything now.
Yeah, I mean, she led out Demi Vollering on the Muir. She dropped the rest of the peloton, you know, with Demi on her wheel, didn't she? She, you know, shouldn't underlook that the role she played there in Demi Vollering's win. She's obviously going to be a huge, huge asset to that team. And I think what's really exciting about what we're seeing with these two teams in particular, UAE and FDJ's, with their strength and depth, is the fact that we are seeing not just the kind of the nominated leaders getting the victories. Victories are coming from all over the place, and that's what is making the racing quite unpredictable. UAE have had 8 victories and they've had 6 different winners. So it's not just Longo Borghini that's taking the wins for them. And, you know, and as we've seen with FDJ, the fact that Demi Vollering can be derailed and go down the wrong road in a race, but they still have Franci Kok and then at least Chabé to take the win, just shows what strength and depth they have. And it may, you know, Strade Bianche was one of the best races I've watched, full stop. It was excitement from ever. The get-go. Huge contrast to the men's race, which we won't dwell on, but it was a great advert for women's racing. And but that strength and depth, it made things so unpredictable in that race. And it was one of the reasons why we had such a tense finale.
It was such a good final. It was such a good bike race. And I know everybody has said this many, many times, but switching after the end of the women's coverage over to the men's and seeing, obviously, a narrative that some people may have found quite familiar. But it just goes to show where we are at in the sport. And it was just so thrilling. And I think the number of contenders, or, you know, riders still very much in contention for the win that came into that final, it's something that we've probably not seen that explosive before in that way, with that dynamic and that number of riders coming in. So I just absolutely loved it. And I think it was just a really telling point in our sport where you're like, that couldn't have been better.
Even with 300 meters to go, you could just pick out of a hat who could win.
Oh, yeah.
It was mad. It reminded me of that kind of finish where, you know, there was kind of 4 riders left and 3 of them kind of almost went into each other and Lee Shabby came along the left. It was like almost, you know, when you watch those speed skating competitions in like the Olympics and they're doing the short track speed skating and then whoever stays out of trouble kind of nips it and gets the win. It was
the defining moment of that finish, wasn't it? There was that Longo Borghini sandwich in that tight left-hand turn where, you know, there was a barge of shoulders. The 3, Kok, Longo Borghini and Nividoma, ended up in the barriers and Chabé had the momentum that the other 3 were stalled and she took full advantage and darted through. And But what I loved about that finish was that you could take apart every single moment of just that final climb and find something new in it, let alone everything else that happened in the race. And I was watching it again this morning and, you know, Chabé was right at the back of the group at the bottom of the climb. And the surge she put in when Longo Borghini attacked to actually get back on terms with Longo Borghini and Nividoma was absolutely incredible. And then for her to find the reserves to finish it off at the end was really, really amazing, particularly because in the race, you know, earlier in the race, it seemed that Nividoma and Longo Borghini had the most punch. They were the ones that were kind of really setting the momentum on the climbs. They were the ones dropping the other riders. But somehow Chabé and Kok found themselves at the front, which I think was the biggest surprise of all.
Well, yeah, that's mad. That's what's so crazy, isn't it? That we did think that Longo Borghini and Nividoma had the punch, but Chabé had been at the front the whole time. I mean, she without doubt, I mean, we obviously talk about this Longo Borghini panini. We shouldn't call it a sandwich, should we? A Longo Borghini panini sounds much more delicious. But, you know, that I think that kind of almost does Elise Chabé a little bit of a disservice because it makes it seem like that moment kind of gave her the win. But she definitely had the strongest legs, didn't she? I mean, she did start that last climb dead last and came to the front and then finished it off and had been at the front the whole time.
You can't deny that she was the strongest rider in the race because she started attacking and was out front from 50k to go. She spent a good proportion of that race in a breakaway, either in a 1-up, 2-up or 3-up breakaway. And then, you know, it would come and go and it would come and go. but she spent so much more energy than everybody else. So to then still have that kick to come up the climb at the same speed, even though we thought she was getting dropped, and then go round Franzi Koch, Longo Borghini and Nivea Doma at the end, is no denying that on that day, Elise Chabé was the best rider in the race.
This whole conversation's got hijacked by the drama of Shani Bankhill, after I'd said, we're going to talk thematically, guys. We're not going to hone in too much, but it's just
it's my fault. But I got too excited. Yeah.
It was such a popular win as well, because she's a rider that, you know, was just waiting to have that big win. And she animates so many races. You know, for a while we were talking, you know, she had the nickname Queen of the Mountains. You know, she's often in the break. And it was, I don't know if this will, I don't know what you think, Lizzie, but whether she'll kind of reappraise her approach to races now, because she's always been one of those riders that has been willing to just go up the road and chance her arm and, you know, see what she can get. But what she showed at the Strada Bianchi was the fact that she can better Longo Borghini and Nivea Doma, riders who were kind of seem at the, you know, top
she
of their game,
best of the best. Yeah.
Even though, as you said, Lisa, she'd been, you know, in the break all day, and maybe this could be a turning point for her in the way she approaches races. I hope not, because I just enjoy watching her race. But yeah, it might make her rethink where she sits in the pecking order.
My gut feeling is that she won't rethink it, but the team might rethink it. And I think the team, it was very clear that the team already believed in her, that she could do it. And, you know, this kind of caliber of race win was possible because, you know, we're going to talk about Trofeo Alfredo Binder as well. And Caroline Finkel's won there.
With exactly the same level of excitement. Yeah.
And it was an amazing win for Caroline Finkel's, but we've got to look at who was on the start list. And at Strada Bianchi, every single person was there. And so perhaps it'll change the way that the FDJ Series United, got that wrong, team go into the races and plan for Elise to ride. But I think at the end of the day, she is an attacking rider. And you can't stop someone like her just going up the road. It's what she loves. It's the way she loves to race. And at the end of the day, with the team that they've got, it is always such a good way to play it. She's got the legs if she stays away. If she doesn't stay away, there's always going to be someone else behind. So perhaps it'll give her a little bit more belief that she can finish it off. But I don't think it's going to change the way she races. I think she's going to stay with that attacking style that she's always had since the beginning. I was on a team back with her in 2019 when she first came over, and you know, even back then, she's always been the same. She's always been that rider that just wants to have fun in the races and wants to get out the front.
But that's the interesting thing, though, isn't it? Because obviously, it's a remarkable win for her. I mean, previously she's won the Tour de Romandie and Tour de Suisse, but I mean, this is like a different level, isn't it? I mean, not technically it's not, but I mean, having a one-day classic, it kind of, everyone is so focused on this one day and going for it that it is kind of like a much bigger win for her. But you know, how much of that is also to do with the fact that we had a lot of the main favorites that we were looking at went down that gravel track that they shouldn't have gone down, following a moto, and took them out of contention.
That was the key moment, really, was it?
Well, no, it's not the key moment, but I mean, it
contributed.
It contributed. And also, because everyone was kind of looking, I do wonder at the team like FDJ, often they get great results when people are looking at Demi Vollering and then one of their other riders. I mean, we've seen that in previous years with Avita Music and Juliette Labousse. They finish really strongly. And then on the races when they are the leaders and Demi Vollering isn't there, then they find it harder to get away. Because, you know, it's so easy when everyone is looking at a rider like Vollering that you can surprise, and people can't drag back every single attack. So you've got a little bit more of a chance to get away. That's not to take anything away from Chabé's victory. But I guess what I'm saying is, you know, we see at UAE and we see at FDJ that maybe these teams do well because they also have a big leader like Longo Borghini or Vollering in their ranks. And there's a little bit of an anticipation that they surely will be going for the win in any given race.
I think you never know. We're always trying to answer things that we can't really answer. Like, would it have made a difference? But I do think, you know, Elise Shabby was just so strong, as Lizzie says, and it was such a deserving win. But I do think she, you know, she really realised in that moment, didn't she, what that meant to her? And she was like, I actually can't quite believe this yet. And I know a lot of riders say it, but you could really sense that that was a huge moment for her. And I just bloody love her as a human being as well. And I just have to chuck it in, Rose. I know it's been mentioned many times on the pod before, but for anyone that's a newer listener, the fact that she was working in a hospital during COVID as a doctor and then just comes back in seamlessly and wins such big bike races. I just think she's an absolute delight to watch, sort of on and off the bike with all her takes and everything. But yeah, a really, really deserving win. But I really do want to talk, if that's okay, just briefly about everybody going, well, not everybody, some of the big favourites, some of the very biggest favourites going off the route. And I feel like a lot of the narrative that I picked up on from perhaps other pundits was that the riders should have had a responsibility there to perhaps know quicker that they weren't following the race route. They've all, you know, they're all armed with that knowledge. And Lizzie, I'd love your take on this, because I mean, as a bike rider that was nowhere near that level, I just think in a moment where you're on the river, you're at that point in a bike race, your head's down, you're following a lead vehicle. I personally thought it was a bit harsh to put so much onus on the riders. What do you think?
I think it's a really tricky one, because the UCI rules, they don't stipulate it directly, but sort of between the lines, the responsibility is actually on the riders and the teams to know the course. And when we've seen this in previous scenarios, it's often been a group that hasn't had a moto in front of them. But in this situation, the motorbike was directly in front of the riders and then went the wrong way. And part of the reason that they ended up being sort of so far off course or taking such a long time is because they went down a hill. And obviously they had that momentum going down there. And one of the riders in that group actually said, "I thought the course had changed." And that is something that happens. And, you know, especially being in the second group, you may not have good radio contact with the car. So something may have happened up ahead. You know, for instance, we saw the incident with the horse on the course with Demi Vollering a couple of years ago. And you just don't know what's happened. So a course can get changed. You cannot know about it. It can not be your fault. So I think it's a tricky one. Obviously, the riders have the map on their head units. Actually, you know, it's a loop that they'd already been on. But when you've got a motor in front of you going directly the wrong way, that's what you're going to do. I don't think it was a defining moment of the race. I think they were far enough back already that they weren't going to get in contact. When you've got a group like that with people like Vollering and Ferron Prevot in it, people don't want to drag that rider back because they're just going to probably win. So it wasn't, in my opinion, defining for the race, but it was a solid cock up, let's say.
Yeah. I
not a Francie cock up.
I find it hard to put the blame on the riders there, because for all the reasons you said, Lizzie, but also from what you could see from the TV footage, there was no marshal on that corner. There's nobody kind of stopping traffic coming in and out,
or a sign, or even any signage,
you know, and which surprises me really. I know it's impossible to cover every single junction, but you know, even a humble Nat B in the UK might have a marshal at a significant junction, or a kind of a motorbike stopping there to stop traffic coming in and out as the race passes. So that was a surprise, and even if you've got the route on your Garmin, are you going to be the rider that takes the risk and thinks, okay, everyone else is going that way, but I'm going to turn left? You know, I mean, that's a big call, isn't it, to make, and in a split second.
I mean, it would be mad to feel like you were that rider. And then also, where would you be left? You're just a solo rider. You haven't lost a load of time, but you've lost all of your companions in the group. So, I mean, you're just going to be, yes, you've gone the right way and you haven't lost all of that time, but you're just now doing all the work by yourself. It's almost like not really an advantage to be the solo person that got it right in that situation. I mean, if it would have been me, I would have just carried on down that gravel path, and I would have just kept going. I would have been too proud to turn back. I would have just...
And I would have followed you, because I wouldn't have wanted to, like, offend you by saying, I think you've made a mistake, Rose.
We would have just found a lovely vineyard somewhere and hidden from our sports directors. And, I wouldn't have turned back.
Saving money on your next painting project. Now at Menards. From your kitchen and bath to doors and trim, and even your ceilings, Dutch Boy has the perfect choice for your painting projects. Dutch Boy's DuraFighter is a tough paint and primer that provides great scrub resistance and durability. Save big on Dutch Boy paints. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week. Save big money at
Menards. Carvana's so easy, just a click, and we've got ourselves a car. See?
So many cars. That's a clicktastic inventory.
And check out the financing options. Payments to fit our budget. I mean, that's...
Clickonomics 101.
Delivery to our door?
Just a hop, skip, and a click away.
And bought.
No better feeling than when everything just... clicks. Buy your car today on... Carvana. Delivery fees may apply.
We did say we were going to talk about Trofeo Binder a bit, because it was another case of, I mean, we saw Anna van der Breggen finished second there, didn't we? And Caroline Swinkels got the win there for UAE ADQ after her team put in a huge amount of work, didn't they, all day. But, I mean, we're kind of seeing the same old SD Works tactics, aren't we? Because I think Anna van der Breggen was, again, kind of not... cooperating. She would kind of go hard on the climbs and then, you know, really didn't want to do any more work than that, and in this instance it didn't pay off for them, the old SD Works tactics. Can we say this is the season where we're not going to see we're not going to be looking at SD Works for the classics now? Like, can we dare to say that?
No.
No one wants to say anything.
No, I mean, I think they were in a difficult position in Trofeo Binder, because Anna van der Breggen was playing a really good team role for a while in that race, chasing down breaks. She said after the race they were racing for Blanca Vass, and they did think she was a good option for the sprint. She came third last year, and you know, we know what a great finisher she is in races. So that was the plan. But she obviously, in covering the move, she found herself in a six rider move with three UAE riders included, and she was covering it, and she, even when the group reduced down to three, she was trying not to work with Caroline Swinkels. And I think the team's view, from what I understand from kind of the race reaction afterwards, was that they just thought, well, the group behind isn't going to make it back. And even when van der Breggen slowed the break down, Otterstadt got back on terms. That kept the momentum going. I think she was in a really tricky position. She tried to lose Swinkels. She couldn't. She knew she wasn't going to win in a sprint. But I wouldn't write off SD Works because of that. In fact, what was encouraging for me, I know the field wasn't as strong as some of the other races, but it was great to see van der Breggen kind of, again, competing for a win. You know, we'd all hyped up her return to racing, hadn't we, last year? And she had that epic, well, epics, I probably shouldn't use the word epic, but she had a great battle with Vollering and Strada Bianchi last year, and I think we'd all hope for a little bit more from her last year, but you know, she still had a fantastic year all considered. So it was great to see her back racing. And to answer your question, Rose, again, I mean, we've seen Kopecky win today. I think she seems to be slowly coming back into form. They've got other riders like Bredevold and Blanca Vass, so I don't think they could be written off. Lorena Vibus might win one or two races. I think they're still a force. They don't have the budget that UAE and FDJ do, but they've still got plenty of winners.
And I have to say, Rose, that I do recall spending quite a bit of time talking about the way that Anna van der Breggen was doing too much work last season.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
So I was quite impressed with a measured ride, actually.
Yeah, I have to agree with Danny. I think with the situation that she had, I think she played it perfectly. And the group behind wasn't coming back. They were just losing time. They were really just shattering time, shedding it actually. And Mia Otterstad was a contributing factor in that getting to the finish, because if it had just been Anna van der Breggen and Karlijn Svinkels, they could have ended up in a track stand position looking at each other. You know, maybe not, because Svinkels was probably pretty confident in the sprint. But for Uno X and Mia Otterstad, it was podium or nothing. And to get a podium in a race like Binder World Tour race, you know, such a prestigious race in women's cycling, that's massive. That's massive for that team and for her.
Who do we think is not performing, or who are we expecting more from, but we're not seeing it yet?
Well, I have to say Little Trek. I think, you know, they've also been through a massive transition, a transformation. Obviously, 2 years ago, they lost Elisa Longo-Borghini, and then and now Lizzie Deignan has retired as well. And so, you know, they came onto the scene in, was it 2019, I think, as this kind of super team. They really set the standard for what women's cycling could be. And since then, everybody else has stepped up. Everyone else has got a lot more money. Everybody else has been able to buy some pretty big riders. And then they've sort of lost their big riders. And now we're entering this era where, is it fair to say they're not really sure who they are? Are they a development team? They've got a lot of really amazing young talent with the Holmgrens, Isabella Reneva, Fleur Moores, Felicity Wilson-Haffenden. But they don't have that killer rider. They don't have that out-and-out winner. So it's definitely a transition period for them. And, you know, they do have Elisa Balsamo, but she, is it fair to say, been a little disappointing this year, not really been on the form that she, well, she's definitely not been on the form that she has been on in previous years, and not really what we expect. So yeah, I think it's a pretty difficult start to the season for Little Trek.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how they develop. Obviously, we are only just at the beginning of all the classic season, aren't we, really?
Yeah. There are several teams without a win, though. I mean, so it's not. I mean, Little Trek at least have a win, a UCI road race win this season. But Picnic, PostNL haven't won a race. Visma, Lisa Bike haven't won a race so far. And you know, they're a team that were considered to have obviously a fantastic 2025 because Ferrand-Prévot won the Tour de France Femme. She won Paris-Roubaix. They have Marianne Vos, but they do seem, we talked about the strength and depth of teams like FDJ and UAE. Visma do seem like a team that is reliant on those two riders for wins, or has been over the last 12 months. So, and without those two riders yet getting their win, you know, they've got no wins to show for themselves. And, you know, they're a team that you would class as one of the biggest. So, for me, that has been a surprise so far.
I feel a little bit like Visma's time will come, and I'm sure of that. And I feel a bit more with Little Trek, like I'm not sure when their time will be or how they're going to get that time. And I'm not, I just don't know who they are anymore.
Yeah.
Not to be melodramatic.
Yeah, I can see it's tearing you up, Lizzie, the identity crisis at Little Trek.
It wasn't that long ago that we were talking. I mean, I think it was two seasons ago when Longo-Borghini was still on the team, and they'd had that fantastic classic season led by Longo-Borghini, but with riders like Sheeran Van Unroy and others, they were really taking it to SD Works, and we were talking about the fact that could this be the team that starts to rival SD Works in the classics. So I agree, they do seem to have lost their way, and I think we talked about them last season when, of course, they made a lot of signings. They signed riders who were, I think I use a terrible term, second tier riders or something like that, but they weren't the kind of the out and out worldies, but they were riders that were capable of becoming those riders on paper at least. And I think they're still at the stage where they're waiting for those riders to maybe, they need one or two of those riders to start making the step up to really try and get those wins.
I think it's also that they've got, you know, riders like Niamh Fisher-Black is a fantastic climber, but I mean, there's not actually loads of races that really suit her because she's a very small, light climber. And most of the season, you're looking to be a great climber, but being slightly more robust and having all these other kind of technical skills on the side. So it's almost like riders are stepping up into a position when they actually need a bit more time to gather a bit more experience and a few more technical skills in order to compete. But, you know, they're really, it's interesting you're saying about them being a sort of becoming a development squad, Lizzie, because it's almost like there's actually no benefit to being a development squad. It's not like in football where you can be a development team and then every time you sell your, you develop a player and then you sell them on and you get a big wad of cash. It's not how it works in cycling. So it's, you need the point, you need the racing points in cycling, you need the results.
You have more riders available for the money that you have. And with the change in the World Tour regulations this year about, you know, having to go to the World Tour races, I think we're going to get into, especially we've got this change in the dates with the Giro d'Italia, and you've got, so then, you know, you've got the Vuelta and then the Giro and then the Tour. And we would have seen all of these, we would have seen a specific set of riders at these Spanish races, but we're not going to see a lot of those riders in the May Spanish races because a lot of them are now going to be preparing for the June Giro. And I think we're going to get into a situation, as we always do every year, where a lot of teams have a lot of riders out through injury, through illness, and are really suffering and struggling for riders. That's then exemplified by the fact that they have to go to these World Tour races. But Little Trek actually have a really large roster because, yes, they're buying, let's call them development in inverted commas, riders, but you can buy more of them. They're a lot cheaper. So they've got, I think, 19 riders on the roster this year, and, you know, some of the teams are really scraping the minimum rider limits, and I think later on they'll be struggling to have the riders in the races and have full quotas.
But, you know, is it then, you know, this is obviously something that Denny will have to get his Casio Nevia-Doma calculator out for, but, I mean, how much value is there to getting a whole season's worth of top 20 results versus in half those races getting top fives and wins? I mean, that's the thing, you know, you've got loads of riders, and yes, you'll be able to field a team in every race, but if these riders aren't going to get the top results, then this is something that I could have worked out.
But it will be interesting. I think Lizzie's right, because the regulations have changed, and because every World Tour team has to now ride every World Tour race bar one, I think later on in the season we could see the dynamics shifting. FDJ only have 16 riders in their squad. Little Trek have 19. UAE have 20. But those three extra riders for Little Trek could play a role when injuries come into play, when fatigue comes into play. You know, when a rider's racing their 50th race of the season, you know, their form will be a lot different to when they're starting. So, you know, and they do have a lot of strength in Elisa Balsamo, Ricardo Bauernfeind, Fisher Black, Anna Henderson, Rihanna Marcus, Emma Norsgaard, Gaia Raylini. You know, when you look down the roster...
Then are you going to try and name all 19?
I'm just saying, when you look down the roster, there are plenty of riders there that can win races. So, yeah, you know, I think... I agree. I agree with the point, you know, have they lost their way? They're not, you know, are they a classics team? Are they a stage racing team? It's not really clear. Whereas FTJ, you'd think, well, okay, they're built, they're made for stage races, but can also win in other races too. But Little Trek, I'm not quite so sure. And they don't really have any out and out sprinters, kind of nailed on winners. Lisa Balsamo being the exception, but she's never been, well, who is of the caliber of Lorena Rivas anyway? But yeah, anyway, so it'll be interesting to see how it all pans out.
How it pans out. Well, yeah, when we were talking about Lisa Balsamo, of course, she was like queen of Trofeo Binder, wasn't she? She didn't actually race it this year because she changed her racing calendar. But let's hear our mini feature, shall we? Because we did want to give a bit more attention to the race, because I think it doesn't get as much attention because it doesn't have a male equivalent race, but it's a very special one, and that is one that is highly prized in the women's peloton. So here is the mini feature.
Everyone asks me, oh, like, when are you racing next? And I go Binder, and they go, oh, I haven't heard of that one. And then you say San Remo, and they go, oh, wow, cool. But like, they're on the same level, like, and I think I'm even more excited about this than San Remo.
It may not get the plaudits it deserves, but Trofeo Binder has all the ingredients that all the best bike races share. An iconic route, unpredictability, and honour roll of truly great champions.
It also has plenty of aspects that make it unique. It's run by a small local organisation in Cittiglio in Lombardy and has never had a men's race equivalent. All this means it has long been a firm favourite for the peloton, including for former British champ Fifer Giorgi.
It feels very like traditional, homegrown and Italian, and it's got a lot of history. But I think the riders appreciate that how important it is a race, even if maybe like the outside world doesn't see it. Like I think us as riders, I know that I always go to it with like massive motivation, equivalent to a race like San Remo or Gent-Wevelgem.
It certainly does have a lot of history. In fact, Trofeo Binda, or Trofeo Alfredo Binda Comune de Cittiglio, to give it its full name, is one of the oldest women's races on the calendar. Here's Bici Pro chief editor Enzo Vicinati to tell us more.
Trofeo Binda started in 1974. It's a race organized in honor of Alfredo Binda. And Alfredo Binda was a former Italian rider who in 1930 was paid not to race the Giro d'Italia because he had won the five previous Giro. And sometimes when we see Tadej Pogacar winning all these races, we used to say they should have to do like they did with Binda and pay him to stay home. He was the Italian national sport director for many years. He was the sport director with riders like Coppi and Bartali. He was really the pride of this small area. This family wanted to do something to take care of his memory. And so they started just women's race. It was mainly, in the first years, it was mainly a race for Italian riders, just a national race. But around that 2000, many foreign riders came to Italy to race it and began to win.
The race has gone from favouring climbers like legendary two-time Tour de France Féminin champion Maria Canins, who won Binda four times in the 80s and 90s, to favouring faster finishers like four-time winner Marianne Vos and three-time winner Elisa Balsamo.
This is a course between the Liège-Bastogne-Liège, I think, and Giro di Lombardia. The start is not always in the same place. The finish is always in Cittiglio. In the second half, they have to climb six times the climb of Orino. And the sprint itself is very, very strange because it's a steeper finish. I remember when Elisa Balsamo won 2024, she beat Lotte Kopecky. That was stronger on the climbs, but she didn't have the legs anymore for the sprint. So you can fight all the day long, but you can lose the race in the last 50 meters.
A key part to the day of Trofeo Binda is the hosting of the junior race, which has run alongside the elite race since 1979. Here's Fifer Giorgi again.
I remember we always came like with the Great Britain junior squad and we'd stay there for like a week and do recons. And Binda was always like the first World Cup on our program. And I think what was nice about it is that you actually do the same course, like different to like Gent-Wevelgem when we were just doing a flat loop and you don't do any of like the climbs like the Kemmel or anything. This, we actually did all the climbs that the elites do. Like when I was a junior, I don't think we even had Flanders as a World Cup. So like we only had maybe Binda and Gent-Wevelgem and Healthy Aging Tour, things like that. So yeah, this was always the first one and it was always actually nice to do it on the same roads that the elites did.
Affectionately known as the Baby Binda, the junior race has crowned champions like Lorena Wiebes, Kat Ferguson and of course Fifer Giorgi herself, who beat Jade Veal to the title in 2018.
The year I won, it was just terrible weather. I remember it was raining and I just remember I was with three French girls and then me and I thought, oh, this isn't looking good. And then somehow they got dropped. So it was just me against Jad. And yeah, we ended up just sprinting against each other. And I think, yeah, I just managed to win. But yeah, like for me, that was a big shock, actually, like a massive, massive result for me. And I was really shocked. And then we got to watch the elite race afterwards. And I don't know, I just remember being so inspired by that. And I got to see, yeah, what were going to become my future teammates, actually winning the elite race. And so that was pretty cool for me.
Fifer stepped up to the elite race the very next year, this time as a Team Sunweb Neopro, riding in support of former Binda champion Corin Rivera.
Yeah, I remember it was completely different. Like the length doubled and the field doubled and just everything. It was like a 10 times harder. And I was doing positioning and I remember I didn't finish. I didn't make it to maybe lap two. It was so hard. And I thought, oh, this is a real reality check, like from winning one year to the step up. And so actually for me, looking back, it's kind of nice to see the kind of growth and development I've had from, yeah, not being able to finish it. And then now actually being able to like race in the finals in the elite race.
The races may share the same roads, but a double win of both the Baby Binda and the Trofeo Binda remains elusive.
It's funny. It's always like a joke we had in the team because I remember Lorena, my old teammate, won it, and Megan Jastrab won it, and I won it, and we're all like sprinter. I'm not a sprinter, but they are sprinter types, and I do lead out. So it's like we always say, it's not the same as the elite at all.
Crucial to the ongoing success of these events is the support of the local community.
All the people in the villages involved in the organization of the race, like volunteers on the road to organize the party after the race. Everyone almost is involved in the race, and people, even old people, most all the girls, they see the girls and they know them by name. This is passion. I think this is passion.
With that local aspect being so integral to the identity of this great race, it's no surprise that some of its most memorable moments have come from its Italian champions.
I remember maybe the first win of Elisa Longo Borghini, because 2013, it was the first Italian win since 2000. 13 years without an Italian win. Elisa was at the start of her big career, and as she is always a strong girl, she cried the day she cried, because it was maybe the first win, the first big win in her career. And then the first win of Elisa Balsamo in 2022, racing together with Elisa Longo Borghini in the same team, and they made a very, very good teamwork, and Elisa won. And she had the world champion jersey, and it was special.
Two-time Binder champion Elisa Longo Borghini played a crucial role in setting up a teammate's victory this year too. UAE team ADQ's Caroline Swinkels out-sprinted Anna van der Breggen to take her first classic win.
It's a kind of a home race where I have all the family there, plus this year I had also my niece, Anna, racing the junior race, so it made it extra special. We wanted a hard race because we wanted to make the sprinters tired. So we attacked and attacked and attacked, and in the end it worked out. And it's been very nice that she could get the win after all the works she did for me this year, and also last year in the UAE Tour. And I think she really deserves it.
This race, named for a 1920s cycling icon, may represent a little slice of a bygone era in cycling, but it continues to stand the test of time. And as the win this year of Italian junior racer Matilda Rossignoli attests, it also offers up plenty of opportunities to look to the future.
I think that all the Italian riders are really in love with Trofeo Binda, because they fought to remain alive. If you see all the winners, you can see a lot of time Marianne Vos, you can see Emma Johansson, Lisa Evanstedt. It's a race for great champion, I think. And doesn't matter if it's a small race. It has a very high technical value. And I think this is the reason why they went on for all these years.
Well, that was our feature about Trofeo Binda. And as was alluded to there, having Binda move and having the introduction of Milan San Remo means that we do have this very small little Italian classics block, don't we, with Strada Bianchi and then Trofeo Binda. And then the upcoming Milan San Remo. Now, we spoke last year, didn't we, about all of our different perspectives on Milan San Remo and how much we like it as a race. Denny, you're a big Milan San Remo stan. I believe you still stand by your Milan San Remo fandom, do you?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, one of the finest races on the calendar.
I feel like
you can't think that.
Denny, that is absolute rubbish. You literally just said, that you thought Strada Bianca was the best. This edition, this women's edition, was the best race you've ever watched, ever.
Well, it was certainly one of the best races I've ever watched. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, I won't repeat exactly what I said last year, but the thing about Milan San Remo is that it has a parkour that can suit so many different types of riders. And so it really isn't.
Does it, though? Does it?
Well, we don't know. No. We haven't seen it play out enough times in the women's. We haven't yet. One recent edition, but you know.
But we're not stupid, Denny.
But, but I like to think there's the potential for lots of different outcomes, and we'll you know, we'll see another Lorena Vivas victory on the weekend. But I think, you know, we've seen in the men's race that the sprinters can be foiled, and I think what I love is that that flat run in the finish means that if you don't have enough teammates around you, if Lorena Vivas didn't have Lotta Kopecky last year, for example, who put in a massive turn to bring back Elisa Longo Borghini, she would never have won that race. And that that could be the situation. You know, if you could be the best sprinter in the world, but if you don't have the teammates to help you out in an unpredictable finale, then you won't necessarily win. So I think I stand by the fact that the parkour kind of makes for exciting racing.
And although Rebecca doesn't love Milan San Remo as a concept,
obviously I do now.
Lorena Vivas
win. It's now my favourite. Exactly. I take it all back, everything I said last year. But no, I think the way that we watch Milan San Remo, or in some cases don't watch Milan San Remo, is a big suggestion of your personality type. And ooh. I think Rose and I, well, I handed my university dissertation in at 2:02. And people will know that 12 o'clock midday is the cutoff, and you literally can only get like 40% after that, can't you, if you hand it in after 12. And I think I arrived rushing in at about 2 minutes to go. So
you're clearly so panicked that you did check that fact. I didn't know about the 40% thing.
Oh, yeah, because it was a real viable thing for me if I'd been any minutes
later.
About
4 minutes to 12, you were probably just spending your time Googling how many marks you might be able to get.
Am I going to go from like wanting to get a really good mark to only being able to get a maximum of 40% after 12 o'clock? But I got my calculations right. I had my Casio Nuvodoma at the ready, and I did get it in on time, and I did get my degree. So anyway, what I'm saying here, you can just cut all this out, can't you? is that you can turn up, you can show up for the end.
So you're saying that Denny's personality type is
you would have got your dissertation in so early that you then had time to learn three languages in the time it took me to actually not even have started writing mine.
Well, no, I definitely had mine in late because I was too busy watching the whole of Milan San Remo from start to finish.
You'd actually fallen asleep, Denny, and you'd missed the deadline by 3 days because you were so bored.
Well, I think it's quite obvious. I was going to ask Lizzie about what her opinion on Milan San Remo was, but I think it's quite clear where you kind of sit on it.
I don't know. I mean, the finish is exceptionally exciting. It's peak bike racing, and you're right, anything can happen. And those last, you know, kilometre or so when you get down the bottom of the Poggio is so exciting. And I love watching someone take that opportunity to take a flyer. And I love watching the frustration of everybody else looking at each other and yelling at the TV, just saying, come on, just work together. And that incredible finish in the men's race in 2017 where Mikhail Kwiatkowski won and he was in a panini with Peter Sagan and Julian Alaphilippe, which reminded me of the women's Strade Bianche with 250 metres to go this year. And so it is so incredibly exciting. But it's just so, so dull before that. So yeah, I mean, I will turn on and then just see that they're riding along a road and turn off again and then turn on again and wait for the end, basically. So I don't know, I'm confused.
Is it? I mean, I don't know whether it feels a little bit less exciting because of the fact that we have Lorena Vivas as a superstar sprinter who can also get over kind of punchy climbs. Does it feel all a little bit inevitable? Whereas if we were in a slightly different women's cycling landscape where we had a bit more of even if we had a sprinter's rivalry that was a little bit closer, then it would be a bit more of a thrilling prospect, wouldn't it? I feel a little bit like it's almost like Lorena Vivas is such a phenomenal rider that she's making the prospects seem boring. I mean, we'll literally be proved wrong in about, you know, 3 days.
No, I don't think it's nailed on for Lorena Vivas, because I think that now, you know, as we were talking about earlier, there are so many teams with so many really good riders right at the top that you can have that situation where you've got maybe only Lorena Vibus is there in from SD Works in that final, but one team might have three riders or two riders. And it totally depends about your positioning on the ascent, your positioning on the descent. You know, you could make a millimeters or, you know, a milliseconds too long braking and get a gap on the descent and then be chasing and chasing to come back. So I do think it's kind of anybody's game. Anything can happen. I don't think it's necessarily just nailed on Lorena Vibus. I definitely wouldn't look at it like that. But I think that end part of the race is super exciting. It's just that if you look at the race as a whole and you compare it to this year's Strade Bianche, where as soon as you turned on the TV, it was excitement, bang, 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 bang. You never knew who was going to win. You only get sort of 15 minutes of excitement in this race. But I stand by the fact that I don't think it's nailed on for Lorena Vibus.
Well, that's we've made a really great sort of advertisement for our Arrivé episode, our first Arrivé of the year, which will be, of course, going out on Saturday after Milan-San Remo, where we'll be discussing a kind of knee-jerk reaction to exactly what happened. Unfortunately, the Milan-San Remo fan actually won't be doing it. So, you know, Denny won't be talking ad nauseum about the first however many 100 kilometres that went, you know, not much goes on, unfortunately.
About the race changing wheel change that happened to some random rider with 100 kilometres to go. Yeah.
You could just make it up now, Danny. You could just pretend that you knew what happened, and honestly none of us would know the whys.
And then we get our Saturday back, don't we?
Yeah.
Household chore productivity goes up during Milan-San Remo.
We're not really encouraging any of the listeners to watch the race. So how else will anybody else
know? We're encouraging them to watch the last half an hour.
And the rest of the race, because they'll miss so much.
You do know there's going to be so many talking points now. And we're all in our hats.
It's going to kick off at kilometre zero, yeah.
Yeah, well, we haven't. It's not just Milan-San Remo that's coming up. Obviously, we start the cobbled classics. Becca, have you got a favourite cobbled classic or one that you're particularly looking forward to this year?
Do you know what? I actually don't think I have a favourite.
No, you can't be on the fence about that as well.
I just don't think. I don't think I do. I don't think I have like one race where, because I. Yeah, you can hear that I've got this revelation in this moment that I don't have a favourite and I haven't thought about which
somebody
one.
Somebody get the ladder out and just poke Becca off of the top of the fence. There's no
but
way
I can't possibly
have.
Offend the race. It's, I mean, when I don't want to talk, you know, when I want to stay on the fence about riders, you know, I just want to be everybody's best friend, but I can't offend the races. Come back to me in a minute.
Okay, because we do have, you know, we obviously have Tour of Flanders, we have Paris-Roubaix, those are all happening before we'll meet up again.
Okay, I'll Denny, go, can I go, I'm going to go Paris-Roubaix. I'm going to go Paris-Roubaix.
She's gone for a really out there choice.
Because I just think you can't, I mean, that final, it's just so special.
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry, Denny.
It is. I think, Denny, you're a Paris-Roubaix, is your... favorite. I'm a Tour of Flanders person myself.
Yeah, Roubaix all the way. If I had to pick one day race, Lizzie, you're right, I would pick Strade Bianche as my favorite race that consistently delivers excitement.
Put that on the record.
Of those upcoming races, I think Paris-Roubaix is my favorite, also not just because of the parkour and the fact that, you know, women finally have the Paris-Roubaix, but also because every race has been different so far. We've had different outcomes, so it's still got that unpredictability factor that I think we all love in bike racing.
Lizzie, have you got a favourite?
I mean, I guess we can't stray into the Ardennes Classics, can we? That's a bit too far ahead in the future. So I'm going to also have
you prefer the Ardennes Classics to the Cobble Classics?
I think I would say as a consumer, I would say Paris-Roubaix without a doubt. You know, it's such a fantastic race. Anything can happen. It's always so dramatic. As a rider, which, you know, never going to be again, but whatever. Liège Bastogne-Liège and Amstel Gold. Well, it's not called Amstel Gold. It's called Amstel Gold. Sorry. I thought it was called Amstel Gold for the men's. Yeah, the Amstel Gold race. The atmosphere on the Kalberg is just So cool. Such a great race, and it's such a dynamic race. I think that's another race, super hilly classic, anything can happen. But Liège-Bastogne-Liège as well, a race with so much history. Just a beautiful race in a really, really, really nice place.
Well, I mean, that was trying to be a great advert for the
I'm
next
I'm glad episode, you didn't say La Flèche Wallonne, because then I would have chucked back at you what you said about Milan-San Remo, which definitely...
I actually like Flèche Wallonne, and I think in the women's race it can be, you know, I think we've actually seen, okay, we have had predictable finishes, but they've been unpredictable going into the finishes in the women's side in the last few years. And, you know, we've also had some really, really bad weather. And obviously, you know, this is looking way ahead now, but all of the classics and, of course, the Ardennes week can be characterised by really, really bad weather. And that often creates really great, unpredictable racing. So, yeah, let's keep our fingers crossed for a bit of rain. Maybe not on Paris-Roubaix. Don't want to see rain at Paris-Roubaix. Want to see a safe-ish but exciting race there, and then a bit of rain headed into Ardennes week. Ardennes week. Sorry, Rose. Oh, just poke the beast.
That's a fantastic advert, maybe not for the Milan San Remo Arrivo that we're doing or for the next episode that we're doing, but it's a great advert for the episode that comes out in May or whatever.
If you stick around, you'll be rewarded.
Yes, exactly. Talking about episodes, I did promise last time that we'd have this my interview with Mags Valieris go out as a friend's special. I did promise that, and then I went skiing and then forgot to do it. But it will be coming out in the next few weeks. So do look out for that. Well, you know, I think that's all from us for now. Obviously, you'll be hearing a lot of us because we're going to have a re-race from all the spring classics coming up. So we won't be away for too long. But thank you very much, Denny.
Thank you.
Or how do you say thank you in Mandarin?
I don't know.
You no, Duolingo hasn't taught you that.
No, I haven't. Well, I can't.
You can probably say something like, the cat poked the donkey. Yeah.
That is what it
this
normally
is
comes
true.
Up. Isn't it like...
Anyway.
Isn't it like share share or something? Isn't it? Is it not? Oh, Denny, you can't Google
you're
this
You're embarrassing
now.
Me now. I can't. I don't know, Rose. I really don't know.
Oh. Oh, dear. Pass. Okay, sorry. Right. Well, okay. Okay. Well, thank you, Denny. And thank you, Becca.
Gracias. Adios.
Oh.
And thank you very much, Lizzie. And I have to say, you know, I'm sure the listeners will agree. It was wonderful to have you back on the podcast.
Grazie mille. In the spirit of Milan Sanremo.
Very nice. Very good. And of course, thank you. Grazie a tutti. Thank you, listeners.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.